Thank you for taking a ride on the Freedom Train Podcast series. I'm your host, Joseph Ward, and as always, ride with me is my homie, Mr. Patrick Irvin. Remember, the Freedom Train Podcast series is brought to you by PAX Inc. That's PACTSINC. And PAX Inc. is a black development organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. For more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org. That way we can learn more about the organization, the members of the organization, why the organization exists, how long it's been existing, what it does into the community, and just everything about it. Also, you can get involved. They have a tab that you can click on that says involved, so you can get involved. So make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org. Also, while you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com. As you know, learn more about myself, Patrick, all of our other hosts of our shows. Learn more about what the Freedom Train has on the horizon because we are expanding. And as you know, we've been telling you about the new weekly lineup. You know, Mondays, we have the Fix Sports Podcast, and actually now the Fix Sports Podcast will be coming at you on Mondays and Fridays. Every Tuesday, you get the Block and Nickel Money Party, hosted by Donnell Durden. Every Wednesday, you get this show, the Freedom Train Podcast Series, as well as the live showing of Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones and Erica Tobit. Every Thursday, you get the Lessons from the Screen Podcast with Patrick Irvin. Every Friday, you get the podcast of Office Hours with Professor Carl Tone Jones and Erica Tobler, as well as I said earlier, the Fix Sports Podcast. Every Saturday, you get Tea Time Black Women Talk, that podcast, as well as the On the Shoulders of Giants podcast. And we're expanding. We have more and more things that is coming on the horizon. Got some hip-hop coming, getting your ID checked, all that stuff we got going on. And, you know, www.freedomtrainradio.com. Follow us on Twitter at Freedom Train Net. Follow us on Instagram at Freedom Train Network. Like our Freedom Train Facebook page. Subscribe to us on YouTube, Freedom Train Network. iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We're there, so you can't miss us. What's going on, Pat?
Not much, man. Just giving everybody a heads up, put more pressure on the people doing the work. We also got a radio station, a live radio, internet radio station coming online shortly. And we got an app that's in the test phases right now for the Freedom Train Network. We're going to be with the app, the live radio station, not to mention bringing on the news. And, you know, we got a lot of things brewing.
We at you.
Behind the scenes.
We at you.
Oh, shout out to our sponsors, too. I want to shout them out. There's a team of them working real hard right here where I'm at in Charlotte. My sponsor is PAX Inc. So they got a after-school program. It's going to be started up next year in a couple of different schools. They got a homeschool co-op that's going to be started up, and they got a they have a mentoring program and a summer program in the works. So shout out to that team here in Charlotte. It's working real hard to do big things.
That's what's up, man. That's what's up. So you ready for this show, man?
Yeah, buddy. Rolling like a big shot, Chevy tuned up like a
pit. Man, I ain't heard that song in so long, man. You know, I love these follow up interviews, especially from people that we had a good time and was able to build a, you know, good chemistry with. So today we have a follow up interview with Mr. Tracy Maxwell, and he has been really out here doing his thing in the community. It's been 3 years since we last spoke with him, and I can't really believe that much time has passed. I'm proud that we're still around. I'm happy that we're still around. You know, but 3 years has passed since the last time we had Mr. Maxwell on. So give people an update on who we got here on this podcast today. So Mr. Tracy Maxwell is a nationally and internationally known and sought-after expert trainer for law enforcement courses and quasi-military behavior style modification programs. He has worked and trained law enforcement officers in both Abu Dhabi and Dubai United Arab Emirates. He is a United States Army retired veteran, first sergeant who served with distinction in the United States Army Military Police Court Regiment. Upon retiring, he became the first commandant of the Florida Youth Challenge Academy, an at-risk paramilitary high school in the state of Florida located on Camp Blanding in Stark, Florida, serving troubled youth ages 16 to 18 for both males and females. Under his leadership and guidance, the Florida Youth Challenge Academy was voted the best challenge in the nation in 2005. He co-founded numerous grassroots mentoring programs for youth, at-risk youth, and throughout the state. And Mr. Maxwell had just, like I said, he's just been doing this thing. So I need y'all to get up off y'all feet, put y'all hands together, man in the little shirt. Go ahead and get everybody ready for Mr. Tracy Maxwell.
Brothers, good afternoon, good evening. Patrick, Joseph, how you been?
We're great, great. Thank you for being on here again with us.
Thank you for having me back. And I want to send a shout out to you guys and tell you I'm very proud of the work that you're doing and continue to do in the community. I keep up with you guys. I may not say much, but I'm definitely keeping up with you. So a shout out to you guys as well.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you. Definitely been an inspiration, been an example that's been set by you and others that we've been doing our best to follow. So we appreciate what you have been doing as well, and we thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to interview movers and shakers who out there actually doing stuff and not get the itch to go out and do something yourself.
Absolutely.
Y'all are definitely motivation for us.
Well, I tell you guys, looking at the work that you're doing, it keeps old guys like me moving forward.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you very much. All right, Pat, you got the first question.
Don't be all humble, man. Accept the compliment with a smile on your face.
I am.
Well, I'm smiling.
Yeah, I am. You got the first question. Let's do it.
Mr. Maxwell.
Yes, sir.
Those who ain't cool and they don't know that you was on our show 3 years ago, although I'm sure now they're going to go back and listen. Right, everybody?
Right.
But for those people, can you give them a little bit of background information about yourself and what you do?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm a native of Florida, born and raised in a little small town called Perry, Florida. I'm famous for a couple of things now. 3 years ago, we were famous for probably one thing, and that was our donuts. But now we have a three-time Super Bowl running back from my hometown. So a shout-out to LeGarrette Blount.
So
I finished school, believe it or not, in 1979. Attended Florida A&M on a football scholarship. Played under Rudy Hubbard for a year. Realized that I wasn't going to be a LeGarrette Blount, so I changed my profession where I joined the United States Army. And I served there until, as Joseph said, I retired from the service. Didn't stop moving when I made a decision to retire from the service. I went right into helping troubled youth, helped youth all over the state. Did that for 5 years. Went over to Gainesville Police Department. Did some work there for the police chief, Tony Jones, with his youth program there by the name of Riker House that has been around for over 20 years. And then I wanted to get back into law enforcement a little bit, so I went out and did some work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Miami for 3 years. Got tired of the palm trees, and I prefer pine trees over palms. So after 3 years, I came back up north, and I did some work in Georgia for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. For 3 years. I think my thing now is 3 years and 3 days because both places I was there for 3 years and 3 days. And after those 3 years, in 2014, I had the opportunity to travel abroad again because I love traveling outside of the United States and just gaining knowledge. Had opportunity to do some professional training in Abu Dhabi and Dubai, training their police and corrections officers. So that's just a quick snapshot of what I've been busy doing for the past 3 years. But in between that, just been giving back, man, to young people and parents.
Yeah, that's amazing. I remember you sent me some pictures of you training. Also, I saw some of you in Abu Dhabi and all those places. So can you kind of give us a little bit of about your experience in Abu Dhabi and how it was kind of different from training people or what you learned over there that you were able to bring back and to help enhance your training?
Absolutely. The first thing right off the bat, guys, is their work days and their training days is Sunday through Thursday. We in the United States work Monday through Friday, but their work days is Sunday through Thursday. So I had to adjust to that. Of course, the time zone difference was about 13, 14, sometimes 20-hour differences depending on the time of the year. So, of course, you have to adjust to that. Met some beautiful people there, law enforcement professionals. With these guys, though, what I noticed, unlike us, we in the United States are in a hurry to do everything. And over in the United Arab Emirates and in the Middle East, they're not in a hurry to do a whole lot of things. Example, if class starts at 8 o'clock, I mean, sometimes I could expect those guys and ladies in there about 8:50. and if I had 50 slides to get through in a slide presentation, during the course of an 8-hour day, I may get through 15 or 20 slides. I mean, it's just their culture is different. But you got to understand, too, their crime rate was only about 3 to 4% crime rate in the whole country. Right. Unlike the United States, I mean, we're incarcerating people at a rate that's just crazy. But the incarceration rate is low. The people are very peaceful. The people are inclusive. I think, Joseph, some of the pictures I sent to you, I could have brought some of them brothers over here and put them in Tallahassee, and you would have thought they were born and raised in Tallahassee. So there's a lot of disinformation that I see that is cast about people in the Middle East on CNN and some of the other news networks that I would just encourage people, get your passport, visit other countries, visit other people, and you'll be surprised of how much you really do have in common. From a training standpoint, because of the language barrier, when I first went over, it was somewhat hard, but I had a translator. I had a translator who stood right beside me and was able to translate to my students in Arabic. And then as I went back and forth over, I got more comfortable with the language where I could hold conversations and teach classes. But believe it or not, a lot of the officers that I dealt with had been to the United States. As a matter of fact, I had a couple of them had graduated from Miami, University of Miami. So there is an exchange program for Middle Eastern people to come over and obtain college degrees, which a lot of people probably didn't know as well.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yes, yes. One of my guys was he was a crime investigation guy, worked in this, what we call the CID department, and he graduated from UM. His name was Saeed Ali, and he was a UM graduate.
Okay.
Which I went, wow, that was truly interesting. But I tell you, those guys and ladies, they come in their Mercedes Benz tricked out on Sunday through Thursday, or their Range Rovers is tricked out, and on Thursday they want to get out of class early, and they're coming in their Ford F-150s and their tricked out Jeeps, and they want to go ride the sand dunes and pitch a tent and barbecue.
Okay. Yeah. So not, but go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Pat.
No, I was just going to ask, why do you think that that cultural misunderstanding is there? Like, why do you think we aren't shown the similarities that we have with them?
At the end of the day, Patrick, that's a great question. At the end of the day, this world is about natural resources and being the top dog. That's what this is about. It's about money and resources in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to tell you guys that. And so what you're going to do, what you're going to find, people in power is going to always beat down what they think is a small man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that I've learned spending my time in the service, and I would go and do it all over again, is that you first got to get the nation's support backing you in order to go and invade somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Once you got the United States backing you, then you basically can go over and be a shyster and rob anybody you want to rob. But again, some of the most inclusive, intelligent people I've ever met has been in the Middle East. I've met guys that own oil fields, and that's how they get their revenue. It's about oil.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys were some of the most hospitable people who I went into their homes and broke bread with.
That's great.
So at the end of the day, it's about those resources.
But like you said, it's about us being able to get our passports, get outside the country, and see things. Because there are a lot of people, especially our people, who haven't gone outside their own neighborhoods.
Yes.
And they believe that life is only as much as what's around them. And we shortchange ourselves when we don't really get a chance to get out and explore the world and see what the world has to offer. So I'm definitely
Absolutely.
With you on that.
Absolutely. What you find our people do, they go to Cozumel, which I love, Cozumel. We're going to
mm-hmm.
go to Jamaica. We're going to go to Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
But I encourage people all the time that have a passport and love to travel. Go to Dubai. Go to the United Arab Emirates. Go to Qatar. Go see Saudi Arabia. And the first thing I vividly remember, I spent Christmas and New Year's over there a few years ago, so I was wishing everybody happy holidays back in the States. And believe it or not, you would go in the mall, and there's Christmas trees everywhere in an Islamic country, playing Christmas music and Christmas trees everywhere. You say, well, wait a minute, that's Christian. No,
right.
That was in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. So I was calling back to the States, and one lady chimed in, and she said, Tracy, where are you? I said, I'm in the Middle East over in Abu Dhabi. And she said, oh, my, be careful over there. Those people are chopping people's heads off. I said, well, wait a minute. I just looked online, and one city that I won't call that city's name in Florida just had their 116th murder. And I'm over here, and they haven't had a murder in almost 23 years. Now, who's really safe?
Right.
that's
that media, though. That's that media.
It's the media. You got to get past that.
Yeah, definitely with you on that. We'll take a story and run with it. Won't even verify it, but we'll run with it, though. So
that's right, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's a powerful point you just made, though, about them. They haven't had a murder in 23 years, and you just had over 100 people killed in Florida. That's
this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So who's really safe?
Well, we had a show last week about social engineering, and that plays into how social engineering is so powerful, because you can get a group of people who live in a dangerous environment to believe that their environment is safer than other environments who are actually safer than that. So
that's right.
Yeah. So I want to ask. Because the trainings that you have been doing have kept you real busy, and you're going around the country. So can you get a little more detail, as much as you can, about the trainings that you conduct and how you actually became a trainer?
Great. I'll start with the second part first. Having spent those years in the military, it allowed me, with my background being military police, it allowed me to get some specialized training. And one of those training programs that I had opportunity to work in was the Advanced Law Enforcement Training Division under my old boss, who did 30 years, Joshua Paul Perry. Shout out to Sergeant Major Perry up in Birmingham, Alabama. We train at that time pretty much all of your shock incarceration and juvenile boot camps in the nation, from California up to Massachusetts back in the heydays of the 90s, all the way up until 2003, civilian law enforcement officers at the federal, state, and local levels came to Fort McClellan, Alabama, and later Fort Leonard, Missouri, and trained in shock incarceration programs. And through the years, those programs got a bad rap. Some of them deserve a bad rap because those people did not take advantage of the civilian training that was provided and offered to them. And some of the people looked at the recidivism rates of some of those programs. And I can tell you, Joseph and Patrick, you know, I can go set up a boot camp program anywhere in the United States today, but if I don't have the aftercare piece, the follow-up piece, the social skills piece, the education piece, the job skill piece, that's the most important piece when you're putting these programs around. And those right. programs that understand that have still flourished, even though it's not that many today. In the state of Florida, I can only think of one that's still in the state of Florida, which is Miami-Dade Rehabilitation Boot Camp there in Miami. They have been around since the 90s. And as a matter of fact, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, did a show called Rock in a Hard Place. He did a documentary last year. And those officers that actually worked in that program and on that documentary, pretty much 92, 93, 95% of those people, I trained every one of them. And I did have the opportunity last year to talk to the producer of that documentary for The Rock. And he was impressed with those people. I mean, the one that I think I can recall right quick is still around also is New York State. New York State prison has probably perhaps one of the largest shock incarceration programs still in the United States. And probably 95, 96% of their people were trained by us. So once you understand the dynamics of the program and what you need to do in those programs, then they're successful programs. I think another thing, another tool that you have to have a great screening process because there's no such thing as a cookie cutter program that's going to work for all young people. You know, some people will thrive in a shock incarceration or a paramilitary style organization. Some kids will not. You have to have a great screening process. So I think having worked in that arena had opened the doors up for me to do a lot of other different things. I've worked in prisons at the adult level, federal level, and I've seen guys look like me. But, you know, you try to drop those jewels everywhere you go. You know, one of the great things I tell people, you know, I say, how could you work in a prison? I mean,
right.
I could have easily been in a prison. When you look at all of the things, all of the factors out there, the socioeconomical factors, I was born to a single mother. My mother was 19 years old when she gave birth to me in little old Perry, Florida. My mother made 50 cents an hour as a domestic worker cleaning up people's homes. You know, so I look at kids, and I remember my own childhood, and I could have easily, if I'd have been born in this time and place, fall prey and be one of those kids that's locked up. I see no way or no hope, and I always think about that. I wake up every morning thinking, how can I impact the lives of families and young people?
That's great. That's what we need. I mean, it's rough out here, and I tell people all the time, it's rough out here and it's real out here. And we need as many advantages as possible because we come up in environments where we're used to being disadvantaged. And so even when we look at people who do have advantages, we look at them like they did something wrong when their parents did what they're supposed to do. So being able to have those alternatives, even though they may not, for some people, they may not be the ideal alternatives. They're alternatives nevertheless that can help our youth be able to make better decisions and become better people now within our society.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I love it. Pat,
yo.
Quiet.
No, I was trying to formulate what I was thinking about into a question, because when he was talking about working in the prisons, I was thinking about something, but then I was also listening and forgot what I was thinking about. So when you started talking, I was like, shoot, let me remember. But I couldn't remember. So anyways.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to work at all levels in a prison. I've worked as a corrections officer. I've worked in compliance, making sure that the prisons are running in accordance to standards. I did that in Miami with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and I've done that with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. So I know prison work inside and out. And hopefully, the Lord continue to bless me. I will try to keep as many young people out of those prisons as possibly can. I mean, I love to ask, but I always ask young people that I see in prison these questions. And I drop this jewel on them. You know, it's big business to keep you locked up. What do you mean by that, sir?
Yeah.
Well, guess what? That food canteen that you ordered there on that kiosk, somebody's making money off your head. Those clothes that you're wearing, somebody's making money off your head. You know, with the privatization of prisons booming and more prisons being built, somebody, their factoring, is going to go on and fill those beds. It's big money. So if I can prevent as many young people from going into that penal system as I possibly can, I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. And I've been on both sides of that fence now.
Do you think our schools, because I've been hearing, especially of late with all of the school shootings, and people worried about the increasing schools becoming more like prisons, but there's also been a school of thought out there that schools basically are prisons. So what do you think about that scenario? Like, what would you say to somebody that said, you know, well, schools and prisons are basically the same thing?
Well, man, what a great, I think I know where you're kind of getting that from. But when you think about it, you're absolutely right. We are telling young people when you need to come, when you sit down, you know, when it's time to eat, what desk you sit in. It's like we are already pre-programming them for the penal system. So I think it needs to be a very big study on that. I'm a proponent of this. I think we should have, up until a certain point, and this is just Tracy, if I was king for a day, gender-specific schools. You cannot take a young man, because I was one of them at one time, and sit me in a desk, and I'm supposed to behave for 7.5 hours a day. I have energy I need to build and burn off. But this is what we're doing. We are programming our kids. And prison is nothing but programming. Prison is nothing but programming. Certain time to eat, certain times you shower, certain times there are recreation. So is it that much different? No. Do they have programs that's programmed at a certain time? Yes. That's the big thing you would hear in the prison system. Programming. We got to have more programs. So we are just reinforcing in prisons what we had already integrated in them as young people.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So I think there, you know, again, there needs to be some study to that. You know, every kid, we're teaching the standardized testing, but every kid is not going to college. You know, I need some plumbing work done now. I don't know anything about plumbing, so I'm going to go pay a guy almost $45, $50 an hour to come and do 2 hours worth of work. There are some kids that are not going to college. Let's get them some skill base.
Now, I definitely agree with that. Michael Eric Dyson was on his interview rounds this past week, dropping his new book. And in the context that he was using the push to make kids go to college, it made sense because he was using it in the context of the kind of a backlash to what Kanye West, the whole thing, and, you know, with him just saying whatever comes to his mind and him being a college dropout, but he was saying that, and I get what he was trying to say, college helps to develop critical thinking, but also being in environments that foster that, that put that forth about critical thinking, about learning, about being able to challenge ideas and thoughts. Because we, like you just said, we have to be able to put our kids in environments that help them thrive. Like, you make me think back when I was a young child. The reason why I did horrible in school. I was not a good student because the environment was not conducive for me to be a good student. So I'm definitely with you. And then I was listening to something. I was watching a video or something the other day, and it was talking about the similarities and the structure of the prisons and the structure of the schools as far as the long hallways, the lighting, the bricks, and all these things here. And I was listening to it, and I wasn't necessarily agreeing or dismissing, but I was listening to it and kind of storing that information so I can use to another time. But it's interesting that Patrick brought that up as well. So.
Yes. Well, I personally think there's some correlation to it. And I hopefully moving forward, someone would do a big study on the psychological aspect of public schooling and prisons. I think that would be a great study.
It's a conversation that I've been having a lot lately, just listening to the way different people feel about it. I didn't listen to the Dr. Dyson interviews, but I tend to agree more with what Mr. Maxwell just said about kids being taught skills, blue-collar skills, hands-on skills and things like that, technical vocational schools and things like that. I don't know, Joe. I didn't hear what Dr. Dyson said, but I don't know that I would agree that Kanye West is a good example of why everybody needs to go to college. Kanye West is a good example of a lot of things.
Well, it wasn't his example to me wasn't the best advocacy for college, and I didn't even think that what he was saying about critical thinking. I don't think college is necessarily the best arena that we can offer people for critical thinking. It just so happened to be an arena where critical thinking should be taking place on a regular basis. So,
well, let me ask you, brother, this. You can be a great critical thinker, and I am a true proponent for higher education. You know, my brother has a doctorate degree from Florida A&M, Dr. Carl Starling, and I'm proud of him. But I like to think that when your lights and you have an electricity problem in your home, and here's a guy with a certification as an electrician, how much critical thinking does he need reading? And that to come and fix your lights and charge you $2,000 or $3,000 for 1 hour worth of work.
Right. But then again, you also make me think that person. Let's say if I'm a professor and I'm calling this person with the certification, like you said, this person with the certification probably making more money than me too. So
could be depending on how your business is.
Right.
I just don't like that narrative. And again, nothing against higher education. I've got my degree. You know, my wife has her degree. We talk to our kids about getting degrees, whatnot. So it's definitely not that I'm against higher education. I'm just against this idea that if you don't go to college, you can't think or you miss out on the ability to develop critical thinking. And I'm also against the idea that if you do go to college, your opinion is more informed or your thought processes are more refined. Or I'm just against all – some of the smartest people I know didn't go to college, and some of the dumbest people I know have PhDs and multiple degrees and whatnot. So I just see that, you know, it seems – and even then, like my experience with college – I didn't have teachers that were pushing me to think critically. I had teachers that were pushing me to memorize information and correctly cite it when I wrote a paper.
Absolutely.
Is that critical thinking?
You know, Patrick, you said something powerful there. This triggered a thought. My stepfather had an eighth grade education. My stepfather fought in World War II. He came out with the GI Bill and was able to go to a vocational school and gain some trade knowledge. And he was probably, I mean, this guy, he to me, he was a doctor at everything. He could lay bricks. He could do carpentry, plumbing work, automobile. I mean, I remember people coming to our house lined up for him, and he would put on a lab coat to work on their cars. So to me, he had a doctorate degree, but he had an eighth grade education.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Well, intelligence is not necessarily linked to what school you went to. So
absolutely.
Definitely. So you have like we said earlier, you have a background in working with youth, behavior modification, co-founding a Rites of Passage to Manhood, Inc., Incorporated Mentoring Program. You've spent a lot of time helping the youth.
Yeah.
From many different backgrounds and many different ways. In your opinion, what elements are needed to truly help the youth? If I'm serious about helping youth, what are elements that you think, basic elements that the adults could be able to use to help them be able to help the youth turn around their lives?
Well, first of all, you got to be consistent. You have to be consistent, and you have to be, as they say, you have to be real. Kids will pick up in the first few minutes if you're genuine and you're real with them. And you have to give them a consistent message every time. And you have to keep your word with them. Because what I've learned in dealing with kids from all genres, the first time you lie to a kid, you're closing some doors.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, if I tell a kid I'm going to do something, and for whatever reason, Pastor Joe, I can't do it, I have to be a man and go to that young person and say, hey, look, I know I said this, I promised this, but I can't do this right now, and this is the reason why I can't do it. If I just blow that kid off and never approach it, I have lost credibility with that kid. So I would tell you, the first thing, you have to be consistent. You have to be straightforward and honest. As I told some young boys today, when I sent out my tweet to them, told them I'm all proud of them. You have my number. You got my Twitter account. Call me. Good news or bad news, it doesn't matter, because you know what you're going to get from me. You're going to get no sugar with no additives. I'm going to give it to you straight. And they trust that. It's about building trust. It's about building relationships. And I've said this 3 years ago, and I said today, when it's my time to transition from this world, I hope that it's held at an amphitheater because it's going to be a two-day ceremony, and because I want kids to come and testify of what the impact, what little impact or what impact I made in their lives to transform their lives. Because at the end of the day, it's not the amount of money I make. It's not about that. It's about what legacy I can leave on this earth when I'm gone. That's what keeps me moving forward. That's what keeps me helping kids. I'm already looking at 2019 kids, 2020 kids. I got a young man now, just went up to Miles College, and I'm going to go ahead and share this to the radio audience and you. This kid is artistic. Artistic kid. I found out about it a few weeks ago. Mother called me. She said, Tracy, we've been trying to locate you for a year. I said, okay, congratulations, you found me. She says, our son has not received any help from the coaching staff or whatever. I said, okay, what's his GPA? 3.3 GPA, 21 ACT. Okay, that tells me this kid is academically, he's a sound kid. But the kid had no help. And I'm proud to say he came back Thursday. He's going to be playing for Miles College this fall, and he's an artistic kid. I mean, and out of all the guys and ladies that I've helped or attempt to help, by far this kid is probably going to be my most proudest kid because he excels in music and he excels on the football field. And give you an example, he will knock your head off for the first two quarters, come off the field, take off his shoulder pad, put on his band hat and his jacket and go out there and play music for a couple of minutes, then come back, put on his shoulder pads, and then for the next two quarters, knock your head off. So I'm excited. I'm excited for his family. I'm excited. I'm excited for this young man. And I can't wait to see what life has in store for him.
That's great. Yeah, that young man got a good, got a bright future ahead of himself. He just keep moving forward.
Keep moving forward.
Yeah, but also being able to have people in your life to help you. Man, if I would have had like a Tracy Maxwell or a Sam Carter or something like that when I was coming out of high school, a lot of things would have been different because, like him, our coaches weren't trying to help us either.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to get over that anger of that because when I was able to look around and really understand what was going on and how the system really works and how they didn't work for us, I was angry because I felt like my opportunity was snatched from me. But then I had to realize that, well, I still have the ability to create many more opportunities for myself, so kind of had to move on. But, you know, being able to have that guidance helps. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, Joseph Patchy, wherever I go, I try to educate the parents. And I tell parents all the time, who better to pimp your child than you? You are relying on a coaching staff to put your kid or place your kid in college, you know. You have to educate yourself. You know, my son was blessed to play collegiate basketball at Division II level, and I learned lessons from that. And since that time, I've went on a crusade to help as many student athletes, and I say student in capital letters before I say athlete, because at the end of the day, I want college degrees from these people that I assist and help. There's two things I tell them. I expect for you to graduate, and I expect for you one day when you're in a position to remember this experience and reach back and help somebody else. That's all I ask of the kids. That's all I ask of the parents. Remember this experience. That's what I want. So, you know, if I would have had, and I had a decent coaching staff, but the times have changed. Parents have to educate themselves on this process, you know, and I tell parents all the time, don't get drunk off the news clippings of your son that you see in every Saturday in the newspaper, okay? Because those news clippings at the end of 4 years, that might be all you have if you have not spent a day out there making sure that Tracy or Joseph or Patrick are taking the right and appropriate classes to be eligible to play Division I, Division II, Division III sports, NAIA. And what's happening, what I see is, and I won't say all coaches, but a lot of times coaches are putting players in classes to keep them eligible to play high school sports.
Oh, yeah.
And not looking down the future. I've had people say, well, Tracy, we just want to get them graduate out of high school. I understand that. But when do you recognize the talent in Patrick? Patrick didn't get his talent in the 10th and 11th, 12th grade. Y'all recognized that talent when he was a 7th and 8th grader.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So yes, parents have to get their PhD in making sure that their student athlete, their kids, are set for success after high school.
Yeah.
What you're saying there is real powerful because I think back and what you're saying is true because I was a track standout and it was recognized. I was a standout in city league football, but my mom didn't want me to play tackle after she saw me take a bad hit.
Right.
So I went to track. And, you know, the athleticism and whatnot was recognized in middle school, but she trusted the coaches and the system to get me where, you know, we both wanted me to be, which was, you know, on somebody's college campus on a full scholarship and then maybe eventually doing something professionally.
Right.
And it just didn't pan out that way because, like Joe said, I didn't have a Mr. Maxwell or a Mr. Carter in my corner to advocate for me, and she didn't know what to do. So, like, what you just said was really, you know, it makes me think back to my own experiences and to a lot of other experiences that I've seen a lot of other kids had. Because you're right, that talent is recognized in middle school, and I never thought about that until you just said it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That talent, you know, I was fortunate enough to watch, I don't know if you guys remember Cadillac Williams, who played for Auburn, and he went and played for the Buccaneers. I watched Cadillac Williams as a 10th grader when I was stationed up in Fort McClellan, Alabama. And I told somebody when I watched him run, I said, that kid is a Division I athlete. They're like, how do you know? I say, trust me, I know. Cadillac Williams went on to play for Auburn. I said, that guy will be drafted in the NFL. Well, how do you know he was drafted? You know talent when you see it.
You know it, right.
You know it. So if I'm recognizing this, I have to start grooming that talent, not only athletically, but academically as well. And that's the piece that's missing. We get drunk on Friday Night Lights, and we get drunk on the news clippings, and we all happy. But then we upset when Tracy, Patrick, Joseph, we got 13 Division I offers. But guess what? We didn't sign with nobody. Why? Because we wasn't academically sound.
Yeah.
That's sad. That's a travesty. People ought to be put in jail for it.
Yeah. I talk about it on my sports podcast all the time because it's a vicious cycle that our young black men get caught into all the time because, like you said, that talent is recognized in middle school and everybody knows how good the young man is, so the family basically puts it on that young man's shoulder to save the family. And he understands that from that young age that everybody's expecting him to save the family. And so now the pressure is on, but nobody prepared that young man for life, whether you on the field or not. Like, life, most of the life that's going to happen is not on that field. And that young man is not prepared for all that. He's not prepared for the amount of, like, just the women who's going to be thrown at him, agents, people who are 10 times more savvy than he is, who are digging in their pockets. They're not prepared for that.
But, again, what's sad is, and it's going on right now, what's happening now, all our kids are visiting, you know, your various colleges for, you know, camps, you know, then they're paying $40, $50 here for this camp or that camp, and then they transition right into 7-on-7 tournaments, which cost, you know, upwards to $150, $120. But I don't see any academic camps going on.
Right.
Because you know what? I can go and visit all of these camps all summer long, but guess what? I still haven't passed my SAT, my ACT, and I barely had a 2.4 GPA. So I'm wasting money. I'm wasting money. And it's sad for our kids even today to continue to think that the only way out is entertainment, you know, or sports.
Right.
And we have got to crack that code to let them know that it's okay to not be either one of those things. And you're absolutely right when you say there's so much pressure put on this kid, because I wrote a thing and I put it up in Medium, and I wrote it to the parents, and it said, parents, what are you going to do when you realize your child is not going to the NFL? Not what the kid is going to do, what you going to do, parent? And I didn't get too many people liking that article that I wrote that time.
But it's the truth. What are you, because let's say the child is 12, so you probably recognize that this child is good at football around 8 years old. So for the last 4 years, y'all been really banking on this kid to save the family. So before that, what were you guys doing? How were you expecting to survive?
Exactly. Exactly. And it, man, I tell you, Joseph, it just draws on a, we had this kid when I was working over in Gainesville at the Riker House, and this kid just quit coming. And so we made a home visit to find out, why was this kid missing school? He was a fifth grader. Why was this kid missing school, and why wasn't he coming up to the center? Well, when we got there, the kid made every excuse in the book, and his mom was a middle-aged lady, and the only thing she thought about was her son going to take care of her when he make it to the NFL. Unfortunately, that kid was not reading at grade level, and that lady, I heard 2 years later, she passed away. And the only thing I could think of, I thought about the young man, but I thought about, wow, man, this lady went to her grave with the hopes and dreams that her son was going to make it to the NFL and take care of her.
Yeah.
And I often wonder what happened to that young man.
Yeah. It was a young man who, it was about 4 or 5 years ago, I was at a summer camp. Now, let me tell you, it was two 12-year-olds. Both were good athletes. One was a football player, one was a basketball player. Now, the football player looked like an 8-year-old at 12. And his stature and size, everything was of an 8-year-old. But the other young man, the other 12-year-old who played basketball, he was 6'3", 6'4", like 170.
Wow.
So he looked older than his age, and the other looked younger than his age. But it was just like two different scenarios. The bigger 12-year-old, even though he's good, his mother is not expecting him to save the family. But the one who's the small one, not saying being small is going to stop him, but that does add more of a challenge. But the family is expecting him to save, and he's only 12. And I'm like, y'all are crazy at 12 years old.
And, you know, when my son was in college playing college basketball, he was the second shortest on the team at 6'2.5".
Mm-hmm.
And I vividly remember I had some tickets. I had a good friend at the time working for the Orlando Magic, and he called me up and he had some tickets. And I took my son to that basketball game. And I used to always tell my son when he was in college, son, you better get your degree because you are not going into the NBA. And his mom used to get angry with me. So that particular time, I said, you know what? You like to go? And we went to the game. It was the Orlando Magic playing against the Los Angeles Lakers, Kobe Bryant, Kwame Brown, and that group.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to go in, you know, watch them warm up and all that stuff. Had good seats right behind the bench. And when... when Kwame Brown and Kobe walked out on that court, I could hear her whisper, "Oh, my God." I say, "What's the problem?" She said, "These guys are huge." I say,
"Right.
That's why I tell your son he needs to get his degree."
Right.
And from that day on, that my son was in college, his mom was on that bandwagon saying, "Son, you need to get your college degree because you are not going into the NBA."
Yeah, because it's like when – looking at those people on TV is totally different.
Totally
now,
different.
Now, what's interesting though, I just ran across Muggsy Bogues on Instagram.
Yeah.
And that's an anomaly.
Yes, it is.
That's Muggsy Bogues had something special about him. But it's so many different slots that need to be filled. Well, it's only so many slots that need to be filled. You have tens of thousands of people. But now that also makes me think about this, because now we're also talking about the things that shape young men into manhood. So can you give us your definition of what manhood is and how you learned to become a man?
Well, I'm gonna answer the second part to that question first.
Mm-hmm.
Again, my mom gave birth to me at age 19. With a high school diploma. But I was blessed and fortunate that when I turned, I think it was 9 years old, my mom married my stepfather. My stepfather had 10 kids, but I was the only one that was raised in his house from a young child all the way up. So mm-hmm. when you talk about work ethic, I watched him get up and go to work every day. I watched him take care of my mother. You know, I watched him make me do things, you know, that I didn't want to do. You know, I hated growing up eating squash and okra and all that stuff that's, you know, supposedly good for you. And I never forget my stepfather would say, "You're going to sit there and you're going to eat that food or you're going to beat me." And my stepfather was probably about 6'4", about 220 in his heyday. Here's a little boy, I'm pouting. And I would sit there and force this stuff down. He said, he would always say, I'm bigger, stronger, and faster than you right now. So unless right. you're going to beat me, you got a choice. You're going to eat this. So I ate it. And fast forward to 1996, my stepfather was ill. I was stationed up in Fort McClellan, Alabama at the time. My mom had transitioned in 1992, and he was having some serious health issues. And I came home to check on him, and he was frail. And he had an appointment to go to Shands, Gainesville, the hospital in August. But he had some friends that said, hey, Tracy, he needs to go, and we think he needs to go now. So the next, I told him, look, I'm going to fix you something to eat. I said, but in the morning, we're getting up and going to Shands, Gainesville. I said, now, you can walk out as a man, or you can be carried as a baby. Because right now, I'm bigger, stronger, and faster than you. So I flipped that script, you know, back on him. But the example of a man is consistency, of showing hard work, showing integrity, allegiance to something by example, not just talking about it. Because a lot of guys will get out and talk about it, and then those cats see them when they're on their way to school or hanging out up on the tree, you know, drinking or playing dice or whatever, which I don't, you know, I'm not going to cast light, you know, some bad to that, but you can't preach. You gotta walk the walk, and you got to talk that talk because, again, it's a credibility thing that's on the line. You know, you may not have a lot, but what do you have? You show it with some integrity. You do it with some integrity, and that's what I had. I had a stepfather. I had a family environment in my little neighborhood where everybody looked out for one another, which that has long gone now. But I had other men in my life. I had men in the military. You know, when you go through basic training, you know, that's just the beginning of your journey, because now you're going to get to your unit and you're going to be assigned other people to take care of you. So it's a journey. It could be a journey with Joseph. It could be a journey with Patrick. And we as men, we have to recognize that there are some young men that I can't reach. There are some young men, Joseph, that you can't reach. There are some young men, Patrick, that you can't reach. We as adult caregivers got to be able to recognize and say, you know what? Tracy and Patrick vibe is not vibing. Hey, Joseph, I want you to talk to Tracy and see can you reach him. I did that with my own son. You know, my son rejected when I would be telling him. So I would go to my colleagues, my buddy, and say, look, even to this day, you know, and my son is 34 years old. You know, some things he don't like to hear me say because I still give it to him without that sugar. You know, but so I would reach out to my friends and say, look, I need you to talk to my son. I need you to talk to him about this right here. That's what we have to be able to recognize as men. There's no cookie-cutter approach to raising these young boys. Some of them we're going to be able to reach, some of them we're not. And we as professional adult-caring men have to be able to recognize that because we have or should have more tools in our tool bag. And we got to be able to recognize that and pass that person off to another man, not just give up on them. It's easy to give up.
Yes,
so that's my definition of what a man is.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Not us, but again, you and this interview is filled with jewels because, again, you just drop some more in terms of being able to recognize your abilities, and not just your abilities, but the abilities of your children. If we go back to a conversation that you guys were having earlier, you know, there are a lot of people that don't recognize that their children aren't necessarily blessed physically with the talents to succeed in the endeavor that they're going after. And there are other parents who choose not to accept that they can't reach their children in the way that they need to.
Yes.
I had trouble with my middle son getting him to accept some of the things that me and his mom do. So I put him in contact with Joe and another man, Professor Carl Tone Jones. Can y'all talk to him? You know, and I remember the reception to, because I asked these two and I asked another guy, and I remember the third guy, the reception was not as positive as it was when I asked Joe and the professor. He was kind of like, well, if you can't reach your kid, how can I reach your kid? So,
wow.
Even yeah, to crazy. That, there's this, I don't know. I don't know how to articulate it right now, but what you just said was extremely powerful.
But I appreciate that. But think about this, Patrick. You were raised all your life that 3 + 4 = 7. Joe is raised all his life that 7 + 0 = 7. And Tracy is raised that 6 + 1 = 7. It's all true. We're just coming at it from a different standpoint. That's right. How I look at reaching kids. We're saying the same thing is just coming from another conductor. Yeah. And my buddies would go and say the same exact thing to my son, and my son would do it. And I would just smile.
Right.
The message was the same. It was just coming from a different conductor. And it was all true. And that's how I try to approach dealing with young people. And I share that with parents. I'm not going to say anything different than what you say. They just hear it right. from somebody else.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing how that works, but it does.
It's amazing. Work.
Yeah.
We've done that with teachers, too. You know, we'll have a parent-teacher conference because there are some teachers that can reach, you know, the children. Can you hint at this or whatever? You don't have to do nothing special. Just, and, you know, you can tell when the teacher said it because you'll see a difference when they come home.
That's right.
Something different. So it is interesting how that works with kids, you know. But it still takes, like you said, a parent that can recognize and accept. And I think that's the biggest thing, because I think we all recognize when we have trouble reaching our kids. But we don't accept that somebody else might be able to reach them better than we can. And I think that acceptance thing is a point that you guys keep hitting on over and over and over again. That's a powerful component to all of this, accepting your limitations.
Yes. Yes.
Exactly.
But you know, when I worked the youth challenge, it wasn't often, but every now and then I would have a young man who is flourishing when he got into that structure. And, of course, the moms were overjoyed. But then I had to reassure the dads that, hey, Dad, it's going to be okay. I'm helping you help your son. Because now if you got a man who cannot reach, let's say, a stepson, then that can cause problems.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
true.
You always have to be leery of that as well. You have to invest not only sometimes times in the young man, but you have to invest times in the dads or the stepdads as well.
Nah, that's definitely true. So when we're talking of, you make me think about behavior modification, because now we're talking about being able to alter the way people behave, basically, so we can get better results. And you actually studied behavior modification in college, and you had the opportunity to not just study it from an academic standpoint, but to apply it when you're talking about your trainings and also your time with your mentorship programs with the young men and young women. So with behavior modification, could you explain to us what it is and how do you successfully modify a person's behavior?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And honestly, I don't know if I'll be able to answer that question. I just know that it's communication, man. I go back to communication. And I go back to expectations, and I go back to using my own life as examples to try to reach kids. You know, you can go and learn all of these things in books and all of that stuff, but what may work for Patrick may not work for Joseph. So you, again, I go back to saying, and you hear me say it all the time, there's no cookie cutter approach in reaching kids. What may have worked for me may not work for Joseph, may not work for Patrick. So you, and again, it goes back to, and you hear me say, we got to have more tools in our tool bag. Some kids, raising your voice, being stern, that may work. But what about that kid who has been abused, threw around in his home, you know, hit by the mom, hit by the dad? You know, all you're doing now is reinforcing negative behavior.
Right.
So if that kid is acting out and he's putting his hand and he's bullying kids in school, now you have to do your homework. So it's more than just talking, counseling, mentoring. You really have to dig up in the weeds, under the rocks, and find out what has been going on in this kid's life. You have to know that before you can start any kind of modification process. Mm-hmm. And what you try to do, what I've always tried to do, is expose kids to as many positive things as I possibly can in the short amount of time that I have. For some, it has worked wonderful, and for every success story, I can tell you a tragic story. I can tell you that young kids, including a young lady who had the opportunity to sit down, meet, talk with the former governor, Jeb Bush, you know, take photos with him. She ended up being in prison for 6 or 7 years for accessory to a murder. You know, and my thing was, what, you know, I sit back and I wonder, what is it? I try to expose you to as much as I possibly can what happened. And she wanted me to come visit her at that time in prison, and I wouldn't do it. I couldn't do it, you know. But that was probably been my question to her. What is it about your time spent with me? What did I miss? So, you know, that's a broad question, Joseph Patrick. But your life lessons and how you came up, Patrick, Joseph, really equips for you to use your own style of behavior modification. Just your life lessons that you learned along. You know, I couldn't sit a group of people in and say, okay, this is how you're going to modify the behavior of kids. That's not fair to those people that sit in the classroom. That wouldn't be fair to those kids, and it wouldn't be fair for me because my approach may be completely different from your approach. So I would just say it's the lessons, the morals, the beliefs, the mores that you've learned along your life that prepares you for behavior modification. I don't know if I answered that question, but that's about the biggest answer that I can give you.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a, because behavior modification is something that's not something you could just sum up like that and just, because it's layers and layers and layers onto it, because you have to be able to break down why the behavior is this way and all those things there. But, you know, it is, you did give us a more of a different angle to look at and more insight to behavior modification as well. So,
yeah.
Yes, sir. So we're at the point in the interview where Patrick gets asked his all-time favorite special question.
If I was Pat, you ready?
yep, Patrick, you ready?
Yeah, actually, I was just looking at the answer he gave us on August 25th, 2015.
Now, let me tell you, when I was writing the questions, I was debating whether I wanted to ask it again. But you know, I said, you know what, I want to ask it again, see if we get something different this time. So
yeah. So. Well, I tell you, man, if I was king of Black America, the first thing I would expose Black America to was life outside of the United States. I would expose mm-hmm. Black America to the great and vast opportunities outside of the United States. I would expose Black America and tell Black America, quit waiting on people to help you when you can help yourself. Quit waiting on a handout. If I was king for a day in Black America, I would load up as many young people in a C-130 cargo plane as possible and take them outside of the country and get them exposed to the riches, the educational opportunities outside of the United States. That's what I would do if I was king for a day of Black America. And if I was king for a day in Black America, not only black America, but America, I would have term limits for everybody up there in Washington, D.C. You do 4 years, you out of there, baby. If you didn't serve in the military, you're not going to be sending anybody over here to fight in these wars over these natural resources. That's what I would do if I was king of black America and America.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I got it.
There it is, Pat.
I got it.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
now, I don't know how much different that was, Patrick, but I know it was.
It was different. You got a lot, you added on a lot more fire and a lot of, a lot of other stuff. The only thing you said that was similar was the last time we talked, you did say that you have mandatory global travel for the youth.
Man, you got to have it, brother. You got to have it because it's a big world out there, man. This Marvel is a big thing, man. I mean, I've been in Greece, Istanbul, Turkey. I've had the opportunity, you know, which would have been powerful if I had been talking to you guys. I thought I was going to be going to Morocco for 2 years. I thought I was going to be going prior to that to Tunisia for 2 years up in both places in North Africa and work there for 2 years. And it fell through, but, you know, hey, I get that blessing sooner or later, and I'll be out of the country for a little bit. And if I ever have the opportunity to take some kids abroad with me, I'm going to do it. I have a great friend who does work now. He's been trying to get me to come to Uganda for probably 8 years. Now, he's doing some powerful work with kids, the war-torn kids who were forced to fight in the armies over there, young men. He's actually started up a school, and it's similar to a Youth Challenge Academy. So I think this year, the latter part of this year, man, if the Lord bless me, you know, I might be reaching out to you, Joseph, and I'll be, you know, in Uganda doing a little work, you know. I mean, I'm just, man, we got a short time here, man, and I'm just trying to get it all in before I have to check out of here. And I just hope that the Lord will continue to bless me, to bless somebody else. And, again, you know, I appreciate you guys, the work that you do for an old man like me. You know, I'm 3 years older now than 2015, but I'm still pushing. I'm still invigorated when I see stuff, Joseph, that you put out there in social media, man. And I listen. And, brother, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you, Patrick, for the work that you guys are doing. I know sometimes that you feel like it's not appreciated or nobody recognizes it, but, brother, you guys are reaching a lot of people. You know, don't give up. Keep moving forward. Every day we wake up, we try to get a little better in this world. We try to, you know, leave a legacy. You know, and when you transition, you want a lot of people to get up and talk about you. So you have a 3-day ceremony, not no, you know, 2-minute speech, and everybody got to sit down. Man, they're gonna have to put me on ice for at least 3 days.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Definitely. No, I enjoy when you come by because you bring that energy, you bring that enthusiasm, and you're always dropping those nuggets that our people need. And I love that you are a military man, but you still are a man of the world, and you think for yourself, and you don't allow anybody else or any other training or thing to cloud your judgment or your ideas of what's really going on in the world. So I definitely appreciate that from you. Definitely do.
You know, I appreciate that, Joseph, and that was another reason. I mean, I probably could have stayed in the Army for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was a fast tracker. I was getting promoted fast. I was doing a lot of great stuff. But, man, I want that to be just a little short blip that somebody talks about one day when I leave here. Hey, he served in the military. Okay, what did he do after that? You know, that's the most important piece to me. Is what did I do after that? I wanted to be a well-rounded, have a whole full life, if that makes any sense. That's what I wanted, man. I didn't want to say, man, here lies Tracy Maxwell. He did 30 years in the military, and that's it. I didn't want that, man. I wanted young people who, generations who are going to marry and have families of their own. Those are the things that I wanted to impact. And it's just so amazing, man, that if you'd have told me, this is how my life direction would have been, I would have just told you, no, my life is not going to be like that. But I'm so thankful that, you know, I've been able to impact the lives of young people who are going off to college you know, like Andre Carter of Stark, Florida, who is going to be the first in his family. He has 24 grandkids. He's a baby in his family who had other athletes, but this kid was the first to have the opportunity to go off to college, you know, and play sports. And he's a pre-med major, man. I'm going to keep driving that home. And I'm just excited about, you know, his future. And I hope I live to see him with his family and remember this experience and other kids. And, man, I got a 2020 female now who's a sports person. That's going to be my real big first female. So, I'm excited. I got to just keep moving forward, pressing forward. And I just hope that I have a few more years here to impact the world and impact the lives of young people.
Yes, sir. So, can you tell our audience how they can contact you and be able to talk to you or whatever, how they find you on social media?
Absolutely, man. I got several ways. The first thing is I've had the same phone number since I retired from the service. My number is 904-349-0045. That's my number. It's on 24 hours a day. My email address is torchlight. That's a compound word, TORCHLIGHT, the number 4@gmail.com. You can reach me by email, cell phone. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Torch4CHANG. I answer all emails. I will respond to your calls. Feel free to call me about anything that you may have, any questions. I'll be more than glad to try to answer your questions.
Yes, sir. So once again, my good people, this is Mr. Tracy Maxwell, and we told you this was going to be a good one, and he definitely, definitely delivered. Thank you once again for stopping by the Freedom Train. As you know, you're always welcome to come be a part of the Freedom Train. We enjoy you. We appreciate what you do and just the impact that you lead. And you are the OG that our OGs look up to you. So that's an extra compliment right there.
Man, I really appreciate it, man. If you ever got anything going on in Tallahassee, hey, let me know. I'll be more than glad to come up and throw my little 1 cent in there. Support, you know, support you, support the cause. I know I haven't made it over, but it is on my to-do list because I owe it to you, brother, to come and support the great things that you're doing. Patrick?
Yes, sir.
I get there when I get there, brother, but I'm going to come.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Maxwell. Thank you for stopping by.
Man, have a great evening.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right.
Yeah, Torchlight for Change. Remember, he is the author and does have a book called The Torchlight for Change, and it's on Amazon, and you can go ahead and get that. Support the brother, Mr. Tracy Maxwell. Pat!
What up?
Let's have a breakdance contest right now.
I just won.
Man, ain't nobody see that. Ain't nobody see that, dog. So you cheat. You cheat.
I'm not cheating. And you said let's do it right now. This is like an audio thing, so you just got to trust that I won.
Did you audibly spin on your head?
I did flares. I did teardrops. I did windmills. I did all
that. You did jazz hands. You did jazz hands, too, then.
No, I did all of that, and I did it in my pootie tang manner.
Hey, man, where you going platinum, then? My poop, dude. You know how poop do it.
Word.
There it is, man. Hey, man. Parting shots in the parting shots.
Power to the people.
Hey, y'all, remember the Fix Sports Podcast coming at you every Monday, every Friday. Remember the Block and Nickel Podcast coming at you every Tuesday. Remember this show, the Freedom Train Podcast Series, as well as Office Hours with Professor Carlton Jones, Erica Tober, every Wednesday. Lessons from the Screen with Patrick Irvin every Thursday. The podcast of Lessons from the Screen. I mean, the podcast of Office Hours with Professor Carlton Jones, as well as the Fit Sports Podcast every Friday. Every Saturday, you get the Tea Time Black Women Talk, as well as the On the Shoulders of Giants podcast. And go visit our website, www.freedomtrainradio.com, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Hey, and I'm an author. I got a book. Go buy my book from On the Shoulders, onthesholders1.com. On the Shoulders of Giants, Volume 1 and 2, where I'll be giving African history information while I'm shedding light on the unsung heroes of the African diaspora. And I just grew a new chest hair. That's 34 chest hairs. What you know about that, Pat? They jealous.
I don't know nothing, because I ain't got no chest hairs.
Man, I got 34 chest hairs. Don't be jealous, people. So, hey, like they used to do in the 90s, put your tools up in the air, put your fingers up in the air, put them apart. Tell them peace.